Okay, so it's now 3:30. I'll just get started. And as soon as I say that, three new people show up. Okay, great. Well, welcome everyone to our Wednesday weekly session in the Deer Park. Now, the way I've been running this session is to do a half an hour of guided meditation and then at least a half an hour of answering people's questions about meditation and Buddhism or whatever questions they have. So, if there are suggestions about changing the format later on, I'm happy to entertain them, but in the meantime, I think we'll go with that. So, first half hour is silent meditation. If everyone can shut down your distractions, shut down Facebook and instant messaging and whatever other things, turn off your phone, set your status to busy, etc. That kind of thing helps. And if you're not interested in the guided part of the meditation, then just shut off your Second Life sound and do a half an hour of silent meditation. For those who are new, I'm going to try to lead you through a practice of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. So our practice is based on four things. We call them sort of colloquially the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's not exactly precise, but it's a well-known name for them, so it works. The point is that these are four aspects of reality, four parts of our experience, or four categories of our experience. So it's just a way of delimiting the boundaries of experience. So anything outside of these four is considered to be conceptual, not a part of reality, and not a part of our meditation. And these are considered to be the four foundations of something that we call sati, which is loosely translated as mindfulness, but it means to remember these things as they are. The word sati means to remind yourself of the nature of the experience. So whenever we experience, whenever we have an experience, every moment that we experience something is a potential for meditative practice and mental development. So we use our very experience to come to understand reality by reminding ourselves of what's really going on and keeping our mind fixed on the reality of the experience as opposed to projecting or extrapolating on the experience. The method that we use to do this is something like a mantra, except it's a word that we use to focus on the experience itself. It's not mystical, it's not magical, it's not hocus pocus, or it's not religious in any way. It just is a tool that focuses you on the experience. So if you see something, for example, you'd remind yourself that that is seeing, just by saying to yourself, seeing. If you hear something, you'd remind yourself, hearing. These are mantras that focus your mind on the experience. So instead of seeing and then judging it or extrapolating on it, you simply see. Seeing is simply seeing, and so on. And this is the very simple technique that we're going to use. It's so simple that it's actually quite difficult to do because the mind, of course, is habitually used to extrapolating, judging, identifying with experience, making more out of things than is actually there. So this is what we're going to try to train ourselves. We're going to try to cultivate the habit of just seeing things as they are. The first foundation that we use is the body. So we start by focusing on our bodily experiences. The classic object is the stomach. When you breathe in, your stomach will rise. If you're relaxed, the breath will be in the stomach and there will be a rising in the abdomen. When the breath goes out of the body, the stomach will fall. So we just see the rising and the falling as it is. When the stomach rises, we say to ourselves, rising. And when the stomach falls, we say, falling. Rising. Falling. And continue with this as long as we're able to. Now, you're not saying this out loud, of course, nor should the words be arising in your head. Your mind should be at the stomach, and you should be acknowledging it sort of in the stomach itself, so to speak. If you find that's too difficult, if you find that's difficult, you can put your hand on your stomach, and that sometimes helps you to experience it. The second foundation for the meditation practice is the feelings. So, from time to time, there will arise pleasant, painful, or neutral feelings in the mind. You might feel pain that comes from the body, or you might feel unhappy in the mind. You might feel pleasure in the body, or you might feel happiness in the mind, or you might feel calm. You might have a neutral feeling of calm and peace. Again, we try to experience these when they do arise, simply as they are. This is another aspect of reality, and it's one that we are very much prone to cling to as well. When we experience a pleasant feeling, we like it, we attach onto it, we cling to it. We hope for it to stay, we wish for it to come back. And when we experience an unpleasant feeling, the opposite, we repel it and recoil from it. We hope that it disappears quickly and that it never comes back. But given that this can't be, and it will never go according to our wishes, we strive in the meditation practice to create a sort of equanimity about all the feelings, that when we feel happy, we just feel happy, when we feel unhappy, we just feel unhappy. And we don't cling to it, we don't react to it, and create habits of reactivity. So when we feel happy, we just say to ourselves, happy, 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 staying with it as long as it's there. And when it goes away, we come back to the body. For example, the rising and falling of the stomach, or focusing on the sitting, just saying to yourself, sitting, sitting. And when you feel pain, say to yourself, pain, pain, pain. Or when you feel unhappy, say sad, sad, or unhappy, unhappy. And when you feel calm as well, say to yourself, calm, 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 just being aware of the experience as it is. The third foundation is the mind. So it should be quite obvious that there's something else beyond these two, and that's the thoughts that arise in the mind. This incessant chatter, the distraction that arises that takes us away from the experience, takes us away from what we're focusing on, what's in front of us. But even the thoughts themselves are not really a negative thing. They're not something that we have to see as a problem. Because, as with everything else, they are a valid aspect of existence. The thinking exists. There's nothing intrinsically good or bad about it. When we get frustrated or upset or worried about the thoughts that arise, only because we're projecting something that isn't there. They're actually only thoughts. They're not good, they're not bad, they're not me, they're not mine. They are what they are. So we overcome this problem of reacting in the same way by reminding ourselves that it's only thinking instead of getting upset or attached to the thoughts. We say to ourselves, thinking, 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 trying to remind the mind of what's really there. Keep it from falling into what isn't there. Then when it's gone, we just come back again to the body and continue noting whatever arises from any one of these three foundations. The fourth and final foundation is at least a couple of important things. The first one being the emotions or the projections themselves. So yes, even our judgments and projections can become the object of our awareness and should become the object of our contemplation. As the idea in meditation is to understand, not to push away. When you understand, you will naturally reject those things that cause you suffering. There's no question of deciding or judging them. It's simply through knowledge you understand what is beneficial and what is unbeneficial. So what are the various judgments that we have? Well, there's liking and then there's disliking. These are the two big ones. And they can be further subdivided into wanting and clinging and the negative side, anger or fear or depression, depressed or bored or frustrated and so on. Then there's the lazy or tired state of mind, and then there's the distracted state of mind, the worried state of mind, there's the doubting or the confused state of mind. All of these mind states that either extrapolate or cover up a direct understanding of the object, keep us from seeing the object as it is, either through direct judgment or through simple confusion, etc. So whatever state of mind arises based on an object or arises in the mind in general, we simply take it upon ourselves to remind ourselves of the experience as it is, as liking or wanting. Or disliking, angry, bored, frustrated, and so on. Tired, distracted, worried, doubting, confused. Whatever arises in the mind, we take that as our object. This keeps us from judging the judgment, keeps us from extrapolating further once we've already begun to judge. And brings us back to a clear understanding of reality. Clear understanding of the experience. Another part of the fourth foundation is the senses, so it's another one of the aspects of experience. It doesn't really fit under any of the other three categories. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking, these senses are how we perceive the physical world around us. And they're another way of looking at reality in terms of how it leads us to, or how we come to extrapolate upon very simple experiences. So when we see, when we hear, when we smell, taste, feel, and when we think, we extrapolate, we judge, we project upon it. So as I said in the beginning, we can just say to ourselves as well, seeing when we see something, instead of looking or staring or extrapolating upon it or judging it. When we hear sounds, instead of listening to them and liking or disliking them, we can just say hearing. When there's someone saying bad things or things we don't want to hear, we can just say hearing, and suddenly we're at peace again. Smelling, tasting, feeling, whatever arises at the senses, just reminding ourselves of what's really going on, so that we don't get stuck on what isn't even there. We don't get stuck on judgment and partiality and addiction and aversion. The base of the four foundations is the body. It's the most obvious one and the most ever-present. So when there's nothing else, we just focus on, say, the stomach rising and falling, or just saying to ourselves, sitting when we're sitting, and being aware of the feelings in the back and the bottom and so on, and the feet. But when anything else comes up that takes our attention away, we simply focus on it as a object of meditation in turn. When it's gone, we come back again to the body. Try to take whatever's clearest, whatever arises that is clearest in the mind, just take that as your meditation object for the time that it's there until it disappears. And then come back again to the body. Okay, so that's half an hour. Thanks everyone for participating in that. Now, if anyone has any questions about Buddhism, meditation, or the monastic life, I'm happy to answer, and I'll be here for at least another half an hour, if not longer, depending on the questions. And if there are no questions, we'll just sit around and meditate. Having a hard time meditating due to people keep knocking on the door. I understand. You acknowledge hearing. I can see it as just sound. And upset when it makes you upset. Then you're actually meditating. I was reading Buddha said we are able of doing harm with the mind. That we can do it with words and deeds seems obvious, but how with the mind? Well, we hurt ourselves with the mind. I suppose there are some talk about magic powers that can actually hurt other people. I don't know that the Buddha actually verified the truth of that, but he did talk about it. I don't know what the question here is. The mind is, it has causal efficacy. It can do things. You can decide to. The only reason we say and do bad things is because of the mind. People don't just say bad things or do bad things randomly without or by chance. It's because of the intentions and the states in the mind. So the mind is actually the cause of all the problems. If we didn't have unwholesomeness in the mind, we would never do or say things that were a cause of suffering. No one wants to suffer. When you move your attention to the body, is there anything beyond focusing on the body? I don't understand. When you move your attention to the body, you're focusing on the body. The things that are beyond the body is the feelings, the mind, and the fourth one, which is just called dhammas. There's something beyond focus. You're not just focusing on the body. You're cultivating clear awareness of the body as not the body, but as bodily experiences. So the rising is an experience, the falling is an experience, and so on. Do you mean that because our intention has its own vibration and energy, and so when we think bad thoughts, it goes out and does harm, or something like that? Oh, you're asking him. Thought doesn't have... hard to say. No, no. I mean, the thought is the, or thought might have some energy to it because it's partially physical, but the mind is what starts it all. All of the things that we do with thought and with speech and so on is, it's all caused by the mind. I suppose the best thing would be if I just sat here and gave a talk, but I don't have anything to talk about, so maybe instead of questions, if someone has something they want me to talk about, just tell me what you'd like me to talk about. I know, I'm a horrible teacher. As a teacher, I'm supposed to think of what to talk about. The problem is I don't know any of you. I don't know where you're at. I don't know what you're interested in. You're not my students. I can't even see you, really. I don't know who you are or where you are. So I need a little bit of a prompting. Rising and falling is the focus. Please explain a bit more. Well, physical experience is broken up into four elements. These are said to be the four elements of the Greek, but they actually do come from India, which I think is before the Greek picked them up. And it's not something, it's not some something that was replaced by the atom, it's or replaced by subatomic particles. The four elements are experience. So you experience hardness and softness, you experience heat and cold, you experience stiffness and flaccidity, the wind element. You don't directly experience the water element, it's said, somehow it's said to be there as the cohesive element, but it's not experience. But the rising and falling of the stomach is clearly a physical experience. It's the called vayodhatu, the air element. It's the stiffness and the flaccidity in the diaphragm that arises when you breathe. And so it's a reality. It's a physical reality. So it serves as a good example of what to focus on in order to start to see how reality works. When the stomach rises, you just know that it's rising. When it falls, you know that it's falling. It's not so comfortable, but that's for the specific reason that reality is not so comfortable. We're not really comfortable living in reality, which is why we prefer to live in fantasy so much of the time. It takes a lot of effort and a lot of courage and a lot of patience to become comfortable with such things as the rising and falling of our own abdomen, which is seems quite strange, I suppose. It's because, you know, it's not stable, it's not satisfying, it's not controllable, it's changing all the time, it's not subject to our wishes and our desires, it's not smooth and calm all the time. So it's for that reason that we focus on it, to try to help us to loosen up and stop expecting things to be according to our wishes. Stop trying to force things. We see that when we try to force the stomach, we force the breath, only create more suffering. So it's a good object of focus, really. It teaches you a lot. It's not so comfortable, but it's quite educational. I heard you mention angels. Can you talk about them? Well, I've never seen an angel myself. I don't know that they exist, but I mean, I know that all of us exist. I know that human beings and animals exist and so on. And the existence of angels isn't that big of a leap. The leap is in accepting that reality is based not on the physical realm that we can't experience directly, but on the mental realm, which we can, or let's say the experiential realm. The physical realm around us is, as far as we know, it's just a projection of the mind. I wouldn't go so far, and I would say that there is something that is better described as physical than mental. I wouldn't want to describe the physical world as just an illusion. But nonetheless, the foundation of it is experience. And if the foundation is experience, then it's not really a far stretch to say that the experience that creates the human realm isn't the only type of experience. That experiences which create angel realms could be just as likely. There's really nothing categorically different about that. The only difference is when you take the physical realm as the a priori truth, or the axiomatic or whatever, you know, the first principle is that the physical reality exists, then you have a problem, because the physical reality is the human and the animal realm in which we live, and it's quite a limited, even though they talk about, you know, the stars and the galaxies and the solar systems and so on, solar systems, galaxies and universes even, it's still quite limited, it's still only physical. And it could very well much be like a fractal. There may be infinite layers of complexity that are nothing like what we experience. You know, it seems to be kind of like that anyway. Fractals exist. The dark matter, and I don't know, I mean, multiverses and so on. It's really the actual reality could be quite, or probably is, much more complex than we think. And so I don't know about angels. I can give you what the Buddhist texts say about them and the claims that are in the Buddhist texts, that people actually saw angels and talked to angels, and people remember being born as angels. It doesn't strike me as odd as a Buddhist. It's just another, you know, I say, okay, I believe it in the same way that I believe Australia exists. I've never been to Australia, and I don't care whether Australia exists, but I believe it because people have told me it makes sense, in the same way that Canada exists and makes sense in all the places that I've been. Of course, Australia is easier to believe in because you see pictures, but you know, there's a lot of things that people say exist, and it doesn't really matter to me whether they exist. As a Buddhist, angels don't, you know, or as a phenomenologist, let's put it that way, because we don't want to say, because I'm dogmatically Buddhist, but as someone who looks at reality from the point of view of phenomenology, or the phenomena, or the experience, it's not a far leap to suggest that this is true. I'm not sure if that's the answer you wanted. You said talk about angels. Well, I talked about angels. If you want to know more about them according to the Buddhist text, I could of course go into that, but somehow that's interesting. It's all conjecture on our part, you know, or not conjecture, but just belief on our part. We believe these things because people have told us. The way you go, you know, going to an angel realm is just having a refined mind. When your mind is more refined than this, you are reborn, or you continue on in a more refined realm. Your experience becomes more refined. Okay, sorry, there's some bunch of stuff here. When someone is saying harsh words, I can say to myself, hearing, but still I comprehend the meaning of their words and feel sad, angry. Am I doing something wrong with the practice? Can I instead focus on something else like standing? No, I mean, it means that probably your concentration is not very strong, which isn't really a problem. But it's also a sign that it is working. Because when you say hearing, you see how your mind works. You see exactly how the disliking arises. This is a very important first step. It's the second stage of insight, actually. Of the 16 stages, the first one is that you see body and mind. The second one is that you see how they work together. So as you say hearing, you see how the hearing leads to judging, and the judging leads it leads to processing. The processing leads to judging, which is the sad and the angry. So you're actually doing it correctly. You're just not at the level where you can actually enter into Nibbana or even be free from the liking and the disliking. But that's fine. The Buddha said when you dislike something, say to yourself, disliking. The point is you're seeing you can't control it, that you're not in charge here. You're not hearing isn't going to poof make you enlightened. It's not going to make the anger go away. You're seeing that. You're seeing that it only goes according to causes and effects. And it'll come back as often or as seldom as it likes, regardless of what you want. So this is teaching you patience, it's teaching you, it's bringing you wisdom, it's helping you to see how the mind and the body work together. When you dislike, say disliking, sad, angry. If you're methodical or systematic enough, you will find that eventually the anger doesn't arise in the meditation. I mean, you have to be fairly systematic and generally fairly intensive about it. It's the kind of thing where you'd want to go off and do a retreat for, even several retreats, I mean, anger doesn't go away in one step, but you should find that as you practice, you become more patient, you become less inclined towards anger. That's really the key sign that you're progressive. Statement about power of mind as well. Yeah, I don't know about the power of the mind. I don't know whether it's true that you could. There are claims in the texts of monks who can set things on fire with their minds, and that sort of thing. So, I don't know. Maybe it's possible. People say it's possible. So I don't. All I know is the most important thing is that the mind is the most powerful thing of all. It's what makes us evil people. It's what makes us good people. It's what brings us happiness. It's what brings us suffering. There's no question that the mind is the most powerful thing. It has nothing to do with lighting things on fire. It has to do with being lit on fire. The mind is on fire. That's a much more important and profound sort of power of the mind. And the power to be able to free oneself from suffering, even when being afflicted in the physical realm. So when people are hearing or saying things to you, and you say hearing, the ability to actually be free from the disliking. But of course, it has to come through practice. It has to come through wisdom. It's not forcing the mind to stay put. It's helping the mind to see what it's doing, and eventually, the mind sees that it's hurting itself by getting angry, and so it stops. The pillow I'm sitting on is not really here, but my mind tells me it feels like it's here. Well, the point is that the pillow is not there. Actually, you're not, I don't know, are you sitting on a pillow at home? You're not actually sitting on a pillow here. But if you're sitting on a pillow at home, then and you feel the pillow, you're actually just feeling something. It's just a feeling. You see, there's something there, but that something is an experience, and it has a physical aspect, it has a mental aspect. The pillow itself doesn't exist. The pillow is something that arises in your mind, you see. All you experience is a feeling, and in your mind you say, oh, that's a pillow. But the word pillow is just a word for a conglomeration of states, you know, or of things, of something, of nothing really. We don't really know what it is. You know, subatomic particles, strings, what is it? We don't know. In the end, what we do know is that there is experience. There's the experience of it. So it's not to say that the physical world isn't here. The physical world is here, but it's made up of experiences. When you don't experience something, in what way can you say that it exists? It's useful to say that it exists so that you remember where your pillow is and you can go back and find it later. But that kind of usefulness doesn't help you in terms of cleaning the mind, purifying the mind, understanding reality, understanding the things that really cause us happiness and suffering. I mean, whether you find your pillow or not is not going to define how happy or how much at peace you are. It's something that we've fallen into for very practical reasons. And it is said in Buddhism that you can die before you die. I don't know what that means. We die every moment. We're born and die every moment. Okay, glad you clarified the whole pillow at home thing. I thought you were actually had the feeling module turned on in Second Life and were somehow experiencing the pillow. So, well, not a very inquisitive group today, but it's great to see so many people coming and taking part and being interested in the meditation practice. Asking, what were you asking again? I forget. Oh, you can die before you can die. Not an actual death in the physical realm. I don't know that. Still don't understand what you're talking about. If it's not death in the physical realm, what kind of death is it? There's three kinds of death. There's death at every moment, because experience is only momentary. And death as a conceptual death, so death, that's the physical death, but it's only a concept. And then there's the death of the defilements, the death of impurity in the mind, the death of attachment and clinging. But yeah, death of the body is only a concept, because of course the body is only a concept. It's funny how scientists how materialists have a difficult time understanding that, because they talk all about subatomic particles and energy and so on, and yet they can't grasp the fact that the body is not real, and so the death of the body is... I guess that there's a reason for that, and that's the idea that the mind is founded in the brain, and when the brain stops working, of course, there's no evidence that the mind continues working. I understand that. It's a logical conclusion to come to. It just happens to be false. Yeah, we were debating whether it's possible to get materialists to meditate, and my big problem is that what's keeping materialists back from meditation is not their views, actually. In my mind, it's the coarseness of the mind, because here we're talking about how important the mind is. Your outlook on life is very important. If the outlook on life is only the most coarsest of aspects of reality exist, i.e. the physical, then it stands to reason that your mind will become, your outlook on life will become fairly coarse. And not in all cases, but in many cases this is what you find, that just as very, very dogmatic religious people become very coarse in their outlook and very bigoted and dogmatic, so too, or even worse sometimes, materialists can become very... coarse in their outlook and rude and angry and dogmatic and snide, you know, a lot of negative emotions. So when I've talked to them about it, they resort to all sorts of ridicule. Not generally ridicule. I mean, I'm quite ridiculed because I wear robes and identify myself as a Buddhist monk, and for that reason they could never take me seriously. And so I get firsthand a lot of these negative emotions from them, which really, it's quite shocking actually, being surrounded by spiritual people all the time, to come in contact with such coarse people, when I would think, you know, these would be the intellectual, high-minded individuals. They're actually not. They're actually quite coarse, and that's exactly what you'd expect from someone who is a self-proclaimed, who only believes that the coarsest aspects of experience exist. So I'm not that confident that you could ever get skeptics, hardcore atheists, etc., to meditate. And it's not because of their views, because those are actually things that you can adjust and relate to. And you know, I've talked to some of them. I've gotten to the point where some of them, where they really do understand that, yes, meditation could be useful, but they'll never practice, you see. They'll agree that, okay, meditation could make you more relaxed, it could have beneficial consequences, but they're never interested. They're much more interested in things like drinking and sex and so on. I mean, this is a gross generalization, but I have met people like this, and so it's an interesting topic, and I'm interested in pointing that out, that we're not just talking about views here, we're talking about coarseness of attitude, which keeps you from doing what you would even agree helps. You see, because a lot of people are like this, they will say, a lot of Buddhists are like this, they say, yes, yes, meditation is a great thing, Nibbana would be wonderful, I believe in Buddhism, I'm a Buddhist. Why aren't you even trying to get inches closer to Nibbana, you see? I think the best we could do is point that out as a warning to if you want to be a materialist, that's fine. If you want to hold those views, that's fine, but be careful that your outlook on life doesn't become coarse as a result. That's naive, obviously. I think it's intrinsic to the view, but it would help people to beware that, well, even if it's just the physical that exists, you still have to be careful to protect your mind, this non-existent or epiphenomenological, I don't think there's even such a word, this epiphenomenon, which is the consciousness, you still have to protect it, and it's obviously not an epiphenomenon, it's something that is both effective and affected by the by and towards the world around it. Well, most meditations for relaxing, and a lot of the theory behind most meditation is limited. Give a couple of examples are what I would say that a lot of the Tibetan meditation, which has tried to focus on the relationships between science and meditation, I haven't, gone into great deal about what they do, but a lot of it focuses on the importance of compassion and how the science proves that meditation leads to compassion, which to me doesn't say anything. I mean, okay, that's fine, but it's such a limited scientific conclusion to come to it. It says nothing to the scientists. It doesn't even say anything to me as a Buddhist monk. I mean, okay, it leads to compassion. Then what? Now, what does that say about the reality? Or the, compassion still deals with concepts. It still deals with beings. It's not dealing with what is really there. It's not solving the hard problem of what really exists. It's not even freeing us from our delusion, our ignorance about reality. Sam Harris is another one who says basically the same thing. This is an atheist who is kind of radical because he does meditate, but he says the same thing. Meditation leads to something very objective, which is compassion. And that's not really the most objective thing that meditation leads to. Compassion is actually, well, it's kind of objective, but it's not very ultimate. The ultimate reality is that everything arises and ceases, that there's nothing worth clinging to, that all of our suffering comes from our misunderstandings and our clinging to things. This kind of thing is real, that what is the nature of experience and the nature of suffering, the nature of happiness. It's not compassion. Even though compassion is a great thing, it's certainly not the core. Meditation and science. What I meant to say as a result of that is, a lot of scientists look at meditation as this, kind of new agey thing. Oh yeah, compassion. Yeah, yeah, lovey dovey. I mean, it's all this kind of hippie stuff, right? When it's not really. Meditation is an exploration of reality. It's taking scientific principles and applying them to the psychic realm. You know, you when you see God, you can't say that it's God, but you can say that it's seeing. So it's subjective for you to say that that is God, I experience God, but it's not subjective for you to say that that is seeing. There's nothing that you can ever say to me that's going to tell me that it's not seeing. I mean, it's ridiculous. There could be no proof or no evidence even to point that that's not seeing. It's axiomatic. That is seeing. Now, what is seeing? We don't know. It's not really important what it is. It is seeing. And moreover, you can see how seeing works with feeling, and feeling works with liking and disliking, and how that leads to suffering. You can see how this goes. This is, you know, along with that, what leads to compassion and so on. But you can see the nature of reality arising and ceasing, and you can see what clinging leads to, you can see what letting go leads to. Yeah, I think another thing about science is it's very much modern science, no? It's very much stymied by money, no? A lot of scientists are just trying to make a living, right? So, you know, the best living comes from telling people they have to pop pills, of course. You know, this is undeniable. It's deniable. There are, of course, people have their values, but, you know, that medication certainly hasn't solved the problem, hasn't solved anyone's mental problems, and yet it's, I would say, the most common treatment of mental disorders. And given how powerful the pharmaceutical companies are, you don't see that that's going to change. Certainly, I'm sure you could find that the most well-paid scientists in the world are working closely with pharmaceutical companies, right? That's, so you have to be quite idealistic and quite strong in values and morals to go outside of that. I mean, I'm sure that's not entirely the case, but I don't think that's wrong. I don't think it's unfounded to say such a thing. I mean, talk to anyone who's taken these pills. No one will tell you this cured me in and of itself of my mental sickness. It covers it up, it maybe dampens it, it can be useful as an aid while you try to deal with the problems. And a lot of people do get off the drugs after a while when they learn to deal with the problems. So they're not bad, but you know, they're certainly more profitable than actually finding a cure. And society loves a quick fix. So that's another reason, for sure. For sure, people just want the pill. Because, you know, why spend years meditating when you can just pop your pills and go back to your delusion? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't like such sweeping statements as society is keeping us away from contemplation. A lot of the stuff about what science is concerned with and how it's all a conspiracy or they're all against us, because the world is clearly in great conflict in terms of good and evil. There are good things that are working for the well-being of people. There are great things in this world. I mean, this Buddha Center is an example of one of them, I think. Just a small example of something that is actually doing good things and spreading good things. There are scientists out there who are doing great things. There's an excellent, in my opinion, of course, as a Buddhist, this would have to be my opinion, there's an excellent quantum physicist, Henry Stapp, out there, who's, some of the things he's written are just incredible, and his rigorous, you know, his incredible research and his stance that things like reincarnation or rebirth are possible, his understanding of the causal efficacy of the mind, some of how he's made it so approachable for people as an expert in theoretical physics. And even society, you know, I've even, some of these ardent atheists that I've been listening to or conversing with, one of them just recently was asking atheists whether they'd ever consider prayer. And he's an atheist himself, so what he means is basically meditation, but he means contemplation, taking quiet time away from the world. And I know this guy, I think he's actually practicing Zen Buddhism, but he's very careful to kind of keep it under wraps because he knows people will misunderstand it. But he's one of the hardcore atheists. He's really anti-religion, anti-dogma, anti-superstition. So that kind of, seeing that kind of thing come up, of course this has to come up. It's going to be a debate that people have. And just seeing me in there and having to grapple with me saying I'm an atheist. Right? This is, here's a Buddhist monk who says he's an atheist. It's interesting to see the reactions. So what I mean to say, there are two conflicting things, of course, the good and the evil. The people's tendency to want to hurt others and hurt themselves, and our tendency to want to help. Tendency to do things that hurt ourselves and tendency to do things that help ourselves. It seems to be that there are both in the world now. I mean, obviously, it's possible to think that one of them might overpower the other and at some point, somewhere, but I think now it's quite exciting that we have both of them and that we are actually seeing the potential for the things that we do. I'm seeing incredible potential just by posting YouTube videos, for example. People emailing saying, my videos changed their lives. And I go, okay, someone I've never met. It's astounding that you could actually change someone's life without ever meeting them, right? I mean, it's not saying that to brag. I'm actually quite surprised. But it's pleasantly surprised. It makes you stop and think that just by putting information out there and presenting it in a way that people can understand, then you can actually change the world in quite a significant way, I think. Or I don't just think, it seems to me from results. But what I mean to say by that is anyone can. I was just a kid that grew up. I was just a kid growing up in Northern Ontario, Canada. I'm not someone special. And yet now look at this. By doing it, I've become, I don't know how much of a figure I am. I don't know how many people know who I am, but there's quite a few and a lot of people. I was walking in downtown Toronto 2 years ago. I went back to Toronto for the first time in a while. And I was just walking down the street, and this guy on a bike says, hey, I watch your YouTube videos. It was just the most bizarre thing to hear. In the middle of nowhere, someone comes and says this to me. So, this should be encouraging to all of us. Not to be, first of all, not to get depressed about the bad things in the world, but second, not to be complacent that things are going to somehow go according to some plan or even some negative plan, that there's conspiracy and we're in prison and we can't do anything to fight the problems. We are the problems, all of us. We are causing the problems in the world, and it's like knots. All you have to do is untie it. Once you untie the knots, it's as though they were never there. All these huge, intense problems with society, right? All the government conspiracies and the rich versus the poor and the 1% and the 99% and the 47% and all this. It's all just figures. It's not real. Real is our experience here and now, and we can have a profound impact for negative and for positive. If we are diligent, if we are patient, and if we are focused enough.